Today's episode of Hidden Forces is made possible by listeners like you. For more information about this week's episode or for easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you listen to the show on your Apple Podcast app, remember, you can give us a review. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? About a week ago, we got news through the media and through Twitter, of course, that the United States would be pulling its forces out of Syria and making way for the Turkish military to begin some type of ground invasion of Rojava and the Kurdish-controlled area of northern Syria. This was something I knew I wanted to cover, and so I reached out to a few people. I booked a very well-respected academic by the name of Joshua Landis, who specializes on Syria. He's lived for 14 years in the Middle East. He grew up for some period of time in Beirut, taught in Beirut, studied at universities in Damascus, Cairo, and Istanbul to come onto the program. But I also wanted to add a different perspective, maybe get the perspective of a journalist who's actually covered the conflict on the ground. And so I also reached out to Jake Hanrahan. Now, Jake is an independent journalist. He's also a documentary filmmaker. He's reported from conflict zones all over the world, including Syria, but also Iraq and Southeast Turkey. He's done so for Vice, for HBO, Esquire, Frontline PBS, BBC News, you name it. And given how chaotic the situation is right now in northern Syria and how much misinformation there is, the last thing that I wanted to do is to add to that confusion. But I felt like bringing on someone with Jake's experience, who also has contacts with people that are actually in the conflict zone right now, would be invaluable to all of you. So again, bear in mind it is early. We're all still trying to figure out what's happening and what's going on. But without any further ado, here is my very timely conversation with Jake Hanrahan. Jake, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thanks very much for having me on.
No, man, it's my pleasure having you, and I really appreciate you making the time as well. I told you that I wasn't familiar with your work, that your name was provided to me by one of our listeners, and I checked it out. I see you've done reporting for Vice. You've got a great podcast called Popular Front, which is pretty unique. How long have you been doing that?
So Popular Front is a year and a half old now, and it did start off as just the podcast, but we always wanted to make it bigger, and it grew so rapidly that now it's basically the kind of, I think it's like the go-to platform for, you know, we say grassroots conflict journalism. We have no financial backers, no venture capitalists trying to get involved. It's all grassroots.
But you also, what's the specific subject of the podcast? It's guerrilla conflicts?
Well, So we cover the niche details of modern warfare. So it's not just the broad stroke. Everything we do is like down to the very minute details of a certain conflict. For example, we did an episode about ISIS suicide car bombs, and the guy that we had on to talk about it had done so much research, even found out the exact petrol stations and car dealerships that ISIS had stolen the cars from to make these suicide bombs, you know? So the level of detail is, I think, the best of anyone doing this, in my opinion, just because I find all the geeks like me that can do it. And then the other side of it is we cover underreported conflicts. So there are a lot of conflicts going on right now, often guerrilla conflicts that you just don't see in the news. And we kind of put it out there and say, hey, this is happening. People are dying here and whatever.
Well, I heard the episode that you did on Greece and covering Exarchia.
Yeah.
Which I agree with you. It's a remarkable neighborhood. And you can feel the political gravity once you get into that central square area. Pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's very like when you're in there, you can definitely understand how young men become radicalized when they live there, you know?
Yeah. So give me a sense of how your involvement in Rojava and northern Syria and You've been, I believe, also in southern Turkey.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in all of this?
Well, firstly, I started covering the... When Kobani was attacked in 2014, when ISIS were moving in there, all the journalists were going to the border to film the airstrikes. You know, the US were helping the Kurds there, the YPG in Syria. But, you know, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something different. And I noticed that there were youth factions of the PKK, basically, you know, angry teenagers rising up and rioting in the streets in Turkey, saying like, why aren't you letting us cross? Why won't you help us? This is right on your border, like ISIS are coming. Why won't Turkey help? So they then became more radicalized. And I eventually ended up doing two documentaries on them. They were called the YDGH. It was the Patriotic Revolutionary Youth Movement. So basically they became the next kind of guerrilla group in Southeast Turkey, you know, radicalized after seeing all this stuff happen in Syria. So I covered that. I was one of the few journalists to actually properly embed with them. I actually got arrested at one point and was sent to prison in Turkey for terrorism, which was, you know, ridiculous, but there you go.
How long were you in prison for?
Not that long. It was like 11 days, but we got moved to four different prisons and it was like, one was a max security ISIS prison and it was just ridiculous, you know, like, and we didn't know when we were getting out. They told us like, yeah, you got 7 years. I was like, what? But then eventually, you know, we just got deported.
They knew you guys were journalists. That's the only reason they let you out, I assume, right?
Well, I'd argue that's the only reason they arrested us, you know, but.
I see. Yeah, interesting.
There was very few. To be honest, at that time, I don't know of any other Western journalists that were in the neighborhoods that we were in when these youth were fighting with the state and the military. So I just think they wanted to, first of all, stop us reporting what we were doing and also see what we had, you know.
When did this flourishing of independent journalism, particularly in conflict zones, really take off?
Independent-wise, I don't know, to be honest, man. Like, for me, I've only been doing it a year since I got sick of the mainstream. You know, I left Vice in, I don't know, like 2016, 2017. And then I was freelancing for a bit, and I did a bit for The Guardian, and I did a bit for BBC, and I was just like, I can't. I love journalism, but I hate the industry. I really do. It's not for me. The mainstream kind of way things are, you have to basically kiss up to people and toe the line. And I just, you know, I understand you have to do that a bit. But after like doing it for 6 years and like being in all these, you know, frontline situations, I just felt like, you know what? I have got more experience than the commissioner telling me no one wants to see that. You know, you get these rich commissioners and they say nobody wants to see it. And it's like, how do they know? So I thought, you know, I'll start my own thing. And it's luckily it's been successful.
Absolutely. I totally get that, man. So I interrupted you. You were giving us background. You were talking about your time in southern Turkey covering the PKK.
Yeah. So then obviously the PKK and the YPG were very closely linked.
Tell our listeners who may not know what those two organizations are and how they're related.
Sorry. So the PKK is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, dubbed a terrorist group by Europe and America and many other, you know, factions across the world. They've been running this insurgency against Turkey for a long time. Since 1984 was their first attack. They've been around since 1978. And, you know, tens of thousands of people have died on each side, you know, in terms of this, because they're fighting for, you know, a free area. They don't even want independence now. They want like an autonomous region within their zone, you know.
The Kurds you're talking about.
Kurds in Southeast Turkey, or they see it as North Kurdistan. And obviously, you know, there's been a lot of oppression on them, you know, not allowed to speak their language, all of this stuff.
There's 40 million Kurds in the greater Middle East?
Yeah, they're the largest stateless people on earth, you know.
They were promised a state after World War I, but never got it, right?
Yeah.
And this has been a source of tension ever since.
Like one of the French treaties or one of the British mandates or something ruined everything, basically. But yeah, so in each quarter, they've been fighting. And when the Syrian revolution happened, there's a lot of, you know, these Syrian Kurds on the border with Southeast Turkey have the same ideology as the PKK, which, you know, there's often a misconception that they're these Marxist, Leninist guerrillas. They're not. They dropped that explicitly in the 90s. They're kind of libertarian, you know, they're kind of, I think that's the closest description. They call it democratic confederalism, but it's kind of libertarian, small government, autonomous zones, autonomous governments. Women is a big part of it, like liberation for women, you know, women are treated equally. Anyway, so they share the same ideals on the other side of the border. The Syrian war starts and they just say, look, let's carve out our own area, which is Northeast Syria, which they call Rojava. So this is the YPG, the People's Protection Units. Now, a lot of the PKK just jumped over the border because they were Syrian anyway and were like, right, we're going to start this up. But now, you know, the YPG has become this huge force where the Americans were allied with them until recently. You know, the YPG defeated ISIS with the help of the Americans and all the Americans have said, these are the best forces we've ever fought with on the ground against ISIS and blah, blah. And then all of a sudden Trump says, like, see you later, because he's made some kind of business deal, it seems, in Turkey. And now they've been completely abandoned. So I was in Rojava in Syria, what, like 2 months ago? It was one of the safest areas. Like, you can do any, you know, it's completely safe there, apart from like ISIS sleeper cells and what have you. And now, you know, for example, the fixer I was working with can't go home now because her house nearly got bombed because they hit a school next to her home and stuff like this. You know, it's
so
madness.
When was the first time you had been to that area in northern Syria? In other words, I'm trying to capture the transformation that you've seen yourself.
So this year was the first time I went there properly around Rojava. When it was 2015 and 2014 when I was there, the border was a lot more like loose, you know, but in Turkey, you can't cross there now. So all of my reporting was in what they would consider North Kurdistan. You see what I'm saying? And then right. Rojava is west. So only this year we've been in through Rojava, but it's a conflict I've been covering from different sides for, what, 6 years now.
So if I understand correctly, once the Syrian civil war really got into effect, that opened the door for ISIS to begin to move into northern Syria?
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, Assad released a lot of jihadists. So when the rebels rose up, you know, the FSA, who were very just in what they were doing, you know, Assad is one of the most totalitarian governments on the planet. You just have to read about what happens inside their prisons to give you an idea. And everybody in Rojava is terrified of Assad. And unfortunately, they've just had to make a deal with him. But yeah, so Assad basically...
But in fact, they're just finalizing that deal now,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, right. And they're like, honestly, they're all the people I'm speaking to out there are just devastated. You know, they can't believe it's ended up like this. You know, when I was there, nobody speaks about ISIS anymore. They were like, yeah, we defeated them. They were all terrified about Assad coming back, you know, because they lived under him. You know, they lived under their rule. You know, yeah. Certain people can't even spell their names a certain way because it's a Kurdish way. So they're forced to write it in an Arabic kind of way. You know, it was very bad. And so Assad released all the jihadists from the prisons to basically combat the rebels. You know, this is well documented. It's not, you know, conspiracy or anything. And then obviously you get this massive resurgence of jihad and ISIS are there and a lot of the former rebel groups dissolved and vanished. You know, the FSA haven't been around for years now. It's mostly jihadist groups now and it's just a real mess, you know. But unfortunately, you know, the only people left were the YPG. They're even, you know, a lot of them call them atheists. I mean, I wouldn't say they're atheists. They're just not particularly religious. But under their grouping, they have Arabs, they have Chaldeans, you know, Syrians, all Christian groups. They have Muslim groups, you know, Arab tribesmen. They have the YPG who are like, a lot of them are, you know, leftist, atheist. So it was this big mix and people lived, you know, there was a lot of problems, but generally people were happier to live under them, even if they didn't like them. You know, we spoke to Arab locals who were like, yeah, I don't really like them, but I much prefer to live under these lot than ISIS, obviously, or Assad. So now that's just all been thrown out.
The FSA is the Free Syrian Army, right? That's like an umbrella organization?
Yeah, it was. It certainly was. It was the organization the rebels initially rose up and they decided, you know, a lot of the actual Syrian army defected when they were told by Assad, like, go and shoot these unarmed protesters. You know, people forget the protests started off peacefully, you know, thousands of people in the streets and then soldiers just came and with the order from Assad were told, yes, shoot everybody. And then a lot of the protest leaders were pulled into prison. Well-documented cases where people are electrocuted by their testicles. This is like a standard thing in Assad prisons. You know, so horrific things happen. So, you know, it was the Free Syrian Army. They decided like, right, we have to coin this term because they want to be the new army that attacks the, you know, totalitarian state.
So when we hear about the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, was that put together in cooperation with the United States? And is that an umbrella organization that includes the YPG and the FSA?
Kind of, not so much the FSA, because honestly, by the time the SDF was created, there wasn't much FSA left, just, you know, due to jihadists destroying it, Assad, you know, carpet bombing and barrel bombing everybody. So there wasn't a lot of them left. But there are definitely some FSA factions, like there was Jabhat al-Akrad, which was a Kurdish FSA faction joined. But yeah, America basically, to appease Turkey, said like, okay, YPG, you know, this Kurdish group, you have to form this umbrella group. And they were like, yeah, no problem. So they, you know, the YPG have been helping other smaller minorities fight as well. So they help arm the MFS, which is a Syriac and Christian group, you know, militia. So they said, like, all the Christians come and fight under us. Not all of them. There are a lot of pro-Christian people fight for Assad as well. But they would all come under them. And there's a lot of Arab tribes. They went to the Arab tribes and said, look, we're forming the SDF. Come and fight with us. Be our brothers, blah, blah. That all happened. And then actually, there's more Arabs under the SDF now than there are Kurds, which is funny because, you know, the YPG's detractors say that Rojava is this ethno state. But, you know, most people that say that have actually never been there. But you know what I mean? It's a big amalgamation and it actually worked really well. You know, I was in Raqqa in September with an all-Arab group of military police. And I said, you know, how do you feel about the fact you're basically, you know, the Kurds are running this? And they were like, look, they came to help us when we needed them. They got rid of ISIS. We're here for them. You're like, they were here for us. We're here for them. And it was actually a really nice coalition, you know. And again, though, it's all destroyed now.
So you said something important that the United States worked with the YPG to create the SDF as a way to appease Turkey. Can you explain that? Can you elaborate on that further?
So there's some incredible mental gymnastics going on here. So the PKK, as we mentioned in Turkey, terrorist group, America says a terrorist, blah, blah. And then they basically form the backbone of the YPG. So then America comes and allies with the YPG because they're like, these guys are not going to cut our heads off. They're happy to work with us. You know, they're not even particularly religious. So there was none of that kind of factionalism. So they turn up and it's like, well, Turkey, rightly so, to be fair, like, well, these guys are like heavily built up by the PKK, who, you know, Turkey hates and America calls a terrorist group. America obviously can't delist the PKK from the terror thing because things don't happen like that. So instead, they just kind of say, well, they're not the PKK, it's the YPG, which now is true. You know, the YPG is not the PKK anymore. You know, like, it is evolved. But certainly at the start, the backbone and the main commanders were from the mountains, you know.
Is there no meaningful relationship between the two organizations anymore?
Oh, no, there is, of course, yeah. Okay. Like, a lot of the main commanders are PKK. But also, you have to look at it like this. You know, I was in an Arab village at one point, and there's all these young Arab men are in the YPG. And, you know, to call them, they grew up in Syria. They've never been to the mountains for educational training. You know, the mountains being the base of the PKK. You know, they've they're not even allied to the leader of the PKK, but they fight under the YPG because they want to keep their land safe. So how can they be PKK? You know what I'm saying? Sure,
right. It seems more that PKK, it seems also like the distinction, and please correct me, is also partly the fact that the PKK is stateless, whereas the YPG is not exactly a state, but kind of, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's fair to say. Like, kind of, yeah. Like, at least had a base of operations, you know, and a safe place to patrol. And whereas the PKK, they're all in the mountains between Iraq and Turkey. So there's nowhere to move there. So, yeah, but
and different objectives, different objectives.
Yeah, pretty much different objectives. But they both want to employ the same culture in the same areas, you know. But certainly the PKK had done a lot of like killing in the 90s. They killed civilians as well, you know, so which is a thing they've said, no, we must not do this anymore. And there's a lot of reforms and what have you. But certainly for America, it looked bad to directly say, yeah, we're working with them. So they just say we work with the YPG instead. I mean, you know, it's kind of a hidden secret, an open secret, rather. Sorry.
Right. OK, so this seems like a common story. Not just for the United States, the Russians as well, foreign powers that ally themselves, pick different sides, ally themselves against allies in some cases. In this case, Turkey is a NATO member, but this was an alliance of convenience with the YPG because they needed to fight off ISIS and the United States didn't want to deploy a large force in Syria, right? And so this, so I think the larger context, and help me here, is that this relationship between the United States and the YPG and the Kurds in Rojava was born out of the fact that the United States was dealing with a serious threat in the form of ISIS, and they wanted to combat that threat, but there were political limitations to what they could do in terms of force deployment in Syria. On top of that, there's cooperation across the border in Iraq, I assume. How did this all come together and how significant has this relationship been in defeating ISIS and in furthering the geopolitical goals, not just of the United States, but also of the Europeans?
Well, there's a lot to it, really. Also, there's another reason that, you know, the Turkey wasn't so involved and the YPG was. It's because when ISIS attacked Kobane, the Kurdish city, there was a huge battle for Kobane, and it's like, it was right on Turkey's border and Turkey basically flat out refused to do anything about it. But then as soon as the Kurds are on their border, then they want to do something about it. You know what I'm saying? So firstly, Turkey didn't want to get involved. In fact, there's footage, you can see it, of, you know, border guards like on Turkey's border waving to ISIS and stuff like this. And it's a very weird situation.
Which is an important point that you make, and I want to emphasize it, because one of Trump's rationales in sort of giving Erdogan the green light to head into northern Syria was on the condition that he would be able to help defeat ISIS.
Yeah, that's absolutely hilarious. It's unbelievable. All you have to do is look at any ISIS, a dead ISIS guy, and look in his passport, and you'll see where the stamps are from. You'll see which country he passed through. Also, the guys that he has just sent, Al-Shakir, which is a Turkish mercenary group that Turkey has sent in as the ground force, they've been training them up, within 4 days, they ambushed and filmed themselves executing a female Kurdish politician and her two guards at the side of the road screaming Allahu Akbar. Now, they don't look that much different from ISIS right now. And also, another thing they've done,
That video. It's horrific.
Yeah, it's disgusting. You know, she's an incredible woman as well, like a very smart woman. She was a civilian, you know, but whatever, there is that. And also, they bombed the gates and bombed certain entrances to ISIS prisons. Firstly, in Qamishli, 5 ISIS prisoners escaped. And then the Turkish-backed mercenaries just attacked Ayn Issa camp, which I was there. And that camp had so many ISIS families in there. The official numbers are now 900 families, ISIS families, escaped from there. Right now, the YPG are trying to contain it. The ISIS brides got hold of weapons since the escape. God knows how they got them. And are now fighting inside. So now they're actually small groupings of ISIS within day 6 of the invasion, and ISIS is back. In fact, day 3, they came together and they launched a big suicide bomb in Raqqa. You know, it's just like the idea that Turkey's going to contain this is outrageous, you know. It's just unbelievable. It blows my mind.
So I have a few questions here because this is really concerning. So it seems to me that this is really a chaotic situation right now.
Yeah, very much so. It's complete chaos.
Is it fair to say that it seems to me from what I've seen in terms of interviews of Kurdish commanders that they were pretty much preparing for the pullout of the United States since December when Trump initially had a call with Erdogan and threatened to pull out, et cetera. It seems, though, that the real issue here isn't so much that they were unprepared for the possibility, but it seems that everyone was just sort of caught blind by how quickly it happened and how messy the withdrawal has been.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, no disrespect, but the Kurds are smart enough to know that America are going to eventually shaft them on some level. You know, if you look at interventions like this when it regards the Kurds, they've always kind of ended up with the bad hand. But they were
also
very...
But this is also a consistent sort of... This is not the first time the United States has done this, where they've allied with someone in the region and then let them to be slaughtered. Whether it was under Saddam Hussein, I forget what was the community in the south of Iraq after the first Gulf War. Bush 1 asked them to rebel against Saddam. In any case, there have been instances before. It's not like the U.S. has, because in the U.S. right now, the story has been presented as if we are abandoning the Kurds and the Kurds feel betrayed and they put all their faith in us. I think that that's a total misreading of the situation, correct?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's a betrayal and an abandonment completely and utterly, actually. Yeah.
Well, what I mean is that as if the Kurds were put all their faith in the United States, that they believed that the U.S. was going to stay and help them out. And I mean, they must have known, not just based on what I just described in terms of the U.S. history in the region, but their relationship with the Turkish state. We talked a little bit about Turkey, but Turkey, I mean, this is the equivalent of a terrorist organization that is building what is effectively an operational base on their border, and they're being supplied by their ally, the United States, with weapons and training, and they're getting experience, work experience, essentially fighting ISIS. So it's understandable that the Turks are freaked out.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, it's understandable, definitely. But then you could argue maybe if they hadn't been slaughtering their kids for the last couple decades, maybe these people wouldn't then turn on them. You know what I'm saying? So it's understandable from their point of view. Absolutely. But honestly, there's a level of naivety to what was happening in Syria. Like, they knew that the Americans were going to pull out, but I don't think they believed that it would happen like this, because you got to remember, they've been working side by side with them. The American Special Forces troops that are in Syria, certainly I have spoken to some of them, and they loved working with them out there. You know, they don't have to worry about getting stabbed in the night. You know, like, I mean, if you look at this operation that Turkey launched, the irony, they call it Peace Spring, literally a day after getting the go ahead from America, on their official Twitter account for the operation, they started like calling America like, oh, look what America does. Bombed Mosul, bombed Raqqa. Look what we're going to do. You know, and they you know what I mean? Like, immediately it was up against America. So, you know, there is this thing where I think the Kurds naively thought, maybe we'll be the next regional partners for them. Maybe they'll allow us to, because look, like, they don't want to align with Assad because, you know, he's a totalitarian, so it's against them. They don't want to obviously align with jihadists because obviously they're the enemy. So then they're thinking, well, the Americans have come here. They see that we're, you know, secular. They see that we have similar ideals in a way. Surely they're not going to just abandon us after, you know, spending all this money to fight ISIS.
Exactly. And on top of that, they've had so much success combating ISIS,
yeah,
and it hasn't led to any significant number of U.S. casualties, if any. I'm not even sure.
Very few, you know, like, and even those were, like, not particularly from frontline fighting, you know, just some other situations. But yeah, it's been incredible, you know, and you go there, man, and they all love Americans. It's the weirdest thing to be in a place in the Middle East, and they're like, no, we love the Americans. They came and helped us. But also the Kurds are almost, by nature, almost too friendly, you know. Like, my friend out there, she said, you know, she's Kurdish, she said, we don't know we have an enemy until they're hitting us in the head, you know, meaning that they just trust almost a little bit too much. So when they're out there with commanders and these Americans are like, we love you guys and blah, 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 they almost take it a little bit too much to heart, not being cynical enough, not realizing that, yeah, they might say that, but the people above them will have to pull them out and it will happen in a second. You know what I mean?
That's an interesting point. So your point is that, yes, they weren't totally naive, but there is a level of naivete.
Yeah. And also, you got to remember, like, this, they literally, like, the head commander found out via Twitter. You know, like, Trump didn't even tell them. Like, there was no one told them. Trump tweeted it basically before anyone found out. So imagine that. You know, they've lost 11,000 of their fighters defeating ISIS. They went all the way to Raqqa, which is not even within their historical boundaries of Kurdistan. You know, they didn't need to go to Raqqa to fight ISIS, but they went because America asked them to and promised to continue a certain level of security. You know, and then they go all the way there and then they find out on Twitter that they're about to be abandoned. You know, it's crazy.
No, it's shameful. Regardless of arguments on either side, the way this has been handled, even for someone like me who doesn't know much about this, and I'm speaking with you in order to educate myself more, I can plainly see that this could have been handled better. But we've become conditioned in the last few years to expect this level of thoughtlessness when it comes to foreign policy with this administration. So,
absolutely. Yeah, it's
terrifying. You were talking about the fact that ISIS fighters and families had started to escape from the prisons. Two questions. One, has there been any thought by the Kurds to actually execute some of these fighters instead of release them? And the other question is, in the case now where they're spreading, this feels very much like a hornet's nest. It almost feels like you've got ISIS fighters, you've got the Turks, you've got Kurdish fighters, you've got the Syrian army, which is beginning to move into the region under a tenuous alliance now that it has with the YPG.
And Russia.
And Russia.
Yeah.
You've got Syrian rebels who are aligned with the Turks, who are also roaming the region. You know, it feels so chaotic. So I've never been to a war zone. The closest I've ever been has been to, we talked about Greece, at sort of the heights of the riots.
Yeah.
That's nothing compared to this. So help me and those of us who have never been in such a situation before understand what's going on right now in northern Syria.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is just complete chaos. So to give you an idea of how bad this is, I'll just tell you something I read about last night. So America abandoned them, right? And then they said, well, you have to continue doing patrols with us in certain areas. And YPG said, look, they released a statement saying ISIS is now the responsibility of the rest of the world. You want to deal with them? You deal with them because we've been doing this for you. You know, they say we fought ISIS for the world. Like, and, you know, it sounds kind of big, but they, you know, you can think of it. They were in our cities. They were killing our children in England. They've been doing it all over the world. So it kind of makes sense. So they said, right, to America, this is what I've been told. This is what seems to be this narrative. They said, look, you either help us, you put up a no-fly zone or get out. And America said, look, we're not doing that. They said, okay, get out. So they said, all right, go. So they left. And then they made this really quick alliance with Assad. Assad says, yes, we're going to fly over here. America has just told them, no, you're not allowed to do that. So America is telling them, firstly, we're leaving. Turkey's going to come in. Your kids are getting killed. But also, you're not allowed to form a new alliance to save yourselves. So basically, you just have to die. Also,
when you say America said they're not, when you say America said they're not allowed, where did that come from and what sort of, what were the conditions of that? Was it just sort of a statement or
yeah,
did it come with
a statement saying that they won't allow for the, you know, Syrian regime to come into the areas of northeast Syria with a no-fly zone and jets and stuff. And it's like, you know, trust me, the Kurds do not want Assad there, but they want less to have their kids killed, you know? And yeah, so it's just this mad mix where you've got these Turkish mercenaries coming in. There is Turkish military coming in. You know, there's a video online of them beheading Kurdish soldiers from last year, you know, shooting women off of mountaintops. NATO don't even talk about it. You know, the videos are out there. So you can see how they act. And then you have these mercenaries.
You're talking about the Syrian forces.
No. This is documented footage of Turkish soldiers beheading someone. Yeah.
Turkish soldiers.
Yeah. Turkish soldiers. It's out there. Like, and again, you know, NATO didn't say anything. It's out there with the badges on. They even say in the video, don't send this on message. Just Bluetooth it so it doesn't get out. Anyway, so you have that. And then you have these militant groups, these Turkish mercenaries going in. Like I said, they've already just straight away started massacring kids and civilians and what have you. Murdered a woman, you know, and the biggest thing about the Kurdish movement is it's a woman, like they say, it's like the women are very high up. Like, you have to look after our women. We will not accept this old chauvinistic attitude. Women are equal. So I think it was a very clear message that the first person they killed was one of their female politicians. So they did that. And then you have,
I didn't have that context for it.
Like, if you think of it that way, it's like, ooh, yeah. And then they have Assad, who literally, like, the reason they rose up in the first place was totalitarianism. And now you have Russia. And basically, it's gone from, like, the most peaceful region to the most chaotic one in a week. Oh, and sorry, to answer your question about the executions, I asked them this as well. It sounds quite dark, but I said, look, why don't you just kill them all? Like, this is outrageous. When I was there, I'd like, it's horrible, but, you know, why don't you kill them? And they said, well, no, firstly, they have a constitution. The constitution is they don't execute people. It's against their ideology, you know? And in fact, they're trying to reform ISIS prisoners. So there's a place where they do artwork and, like, camps and stuff with them to try and reform them and bring them away from jihad with the less serious ones. So they don't do that. They won't execute. It's against their nature. They're very into, like, ecology and human nature and loving animals, you know. The only people I've seen in the Middle East who love dogs, do you know what I mean? So it's
interesting. Yeah, really, they love dogs.
Oh,
huh?
They love dogs out there. It's weird to me. I'm like, what? Like, everywhere else hates them. But yeah, so it's like that. And also, which is, you know, that's maybe propaganda. I don't think it is. I've been around them and it's, you know, when I suggested killing them, they're like, but the thing is also it looks very bad in the international community. You basically just give them what they want then. If they just executed everybody, all their naysayers would go, see, look what they did. They just killed all these people. And then thirdly, it would cause an uprising. You got to remember a lot of these ISIS families, their families are free. You know, their mums, dads are free. And if you suddenly kill all their kids in the ISIS prison, you know,
exactly.
They deserve it.
Also, that's a lot of people. It's easy for me to... I just threw it out there because I just wanted an answer to it.
No, a lot of people have been asking it, man. A lot of people
But it does seem ridiculous because they have... Isn't it tens of thousands of ISIS fighters they have as prisoners?
Oh, yeah. Like, I think in our whole camp, there's something like 70,000 people there. I was there and, like, you have to walk around with a guard because the ISIS brides have been stabbing people. Like, they stabbed 3 Asayish, which are their guards. They even got a gun recently. They killed their own now as well. So they have basically Al Hol camp is where the ISIS brides stay. I mean, I don't call them ISIS brides. They're ISIS female members. And they killed one. This grandmother killed her own granddaughter this year because she was like, I don't want to wear the veil anymore. Like, I want to be free. Like, the female fighters in the Kurds don't make the women wear veils or anything. So they killed the child, you know. And then there's another one. They found another kid burned to death by the ISIS women themselves. So this is what they're combating. Another hilarious thing is they all wear the niqab, right? So you can't see the face. And a lot of international groups, you know, the NGOs have said you can't make them lift their veil to take a picture. That's racist or that's Islamophobia. So you got all these women are wandering around head to toe in black. No one knows who they are. There's no identifications. They stab someone and they just blend into a crowd. How the hell are you going to find that person, you know? It's insane. It was a powder keg waiting to go when I was there in September. Now there's been rioting. It's over. You know, it's over. They're all going to get out.
So what does all this mean, Jake? I mean, we sort of have a general sense of what's happening now from news reports. It's very early.
Yeah.
There's so much misinformation. Mm. I want to be as responsible as I can with what we discuss. You spoke with some of your friends. You mentioned one of your fixers there.
Yeah. So that's like the person
who had his house bombed. Exactly.
Yeah.
So how does this play out right now?
Well, frankly, I think, unfortunately, it's the end of the project. You know, the Rojava project, one of the most, and it's not just me, ask anyone, like even people that don't like them that have been there will have to admit a certain level of how incredible it is what they managed to do. You know, a woman's revolution in one of the most hostile places on earth. It's insane. Unifying like Arab tribes with Christian Syriac fighters happily, you know, fighting side by side and having an alliance with the American government. Like, it's mad. But unfortunately, it's all done. You know, I think it's finished. So there's a lot of the Arab elements of the SDF are not going to want to fight alongside the Arab, you know, the Syrian government. I mean, the Kurds don't want to either, but they want to protect the homeland. So I think it's the end of it. You know, I think it's all going to crumble. I think Assad will end up taking control over the whole region and basically win. You know, I mean, my friend said the other day on Twitter, the irony is that this is a true headline. Even though all the actors mostly involved are bad, he said, in a way, this is true. And he said, like, Syrian government and Russia come to defend Kurds from jihadist massacre after US abandons them. And he was like, if you wrote that like a couple months ago, it would have been a joke. But he's like, this is actually a real headline almost. You know what I mean? Not that Assad is the good guy by any stretch or Russia, but it just is what it is right now. So, you know, unfortunately, I think America was slowly starting to fix some of its reputation in the Middle East through what they've done. And I think Trump has done a very bad thing here. I really do think that. And again, like, yeah, all these children are dying. You know, it's just so many. It's indiscriminate shelling. You know, I've got two friends out there right now. And every time we speak every night, and it's just, I can hear it. You know, and they're like, oh, another shell. It's just crazy.
You know, it's tough talking to you about this because I, you know, usually do episodes. They're very head oriented. I've done some that are more, you know, personable, dealing with depression or rape or things like this, but those are very specific. This is a difficult conversation to have because my next question was going to be something along the lines of it seems that there are sort of three bases of power. There's Turkey, there's, you know, Syria and its new allies like Russia and the YPG and then ISIS. But that would really overlook what we're talking about here. And I just don't know how to really... I don't know where to begin to empathize with this situation.
Yeah.
You know, I can see these videos and I can read about it and I can hear you talk to me about it. And I was hanging out here yesterday. I was actually at the gym and I was stretching afterwards. And I just thought, I'm living in a world where I can just walk around and do whatever I want. And my biggest concerns are not even concerns. And here we have a complete chaotic situation where people now are going to begin to get murdered left and right. And we now have, as you mentioned, all these ISIS fighters are going to escape. I mean, I just didn't want to over, I don't know. It's, no, I have a hard time knowing what to say about it.
No, I get what you're saying actually, because it's something I've been saying. There's a big problem within mainstream journalism where the idea of complete objectivity, which doesn't exist, is some reason to be almost psychopathic. So they become almost like, they put no feeling into this, whereas I don't care about that. I've met these people, I've been around them, I've been alongside them as they fight, I've ate with them. There is no way not to feel compassion for these people. You know what I'm saying? And it's so sad. Like, for me, I feel it even more so because I've been with, you know, Habat, the person I work with out there, this amazing fixer, like one of the best people I've ever met in my life. And then I'm home now chilling, you know, after we had this great time filming and doing all this cool stuff in Rojava. And then, like, she'll call me and you can just hear the fear in her voice. And it's like, this is horrible.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And she's like, I don't know. I'm like, what are you going to do? She's like, I don't know. I might be dead next week. I'm not thinking that far ahead. And, you know, and I know other people I've spoken to as well who are other females there who are saying, like, talking, I know this is happening for a fact. Like, they're talking to each other, working out what's the best way to kill ourselves just in case the jihadists...
These are people that you know.
Yeah, people I know. Literally saying, like, what if the Turkish mercenaries get close? We have to kill ourselves before, because obviously you know what they're going to do to women. So, you know, and that they're saying, well, we don't want to shoot ourselves because we don't want our family to see the images. So what pills can we take to kill ourselves, you know? And it's, people might say, oh, that's very dramatic. Well, yeah, they're living in a war. You know, it's, these are the things you don't see, man. Like, kids just hanging out, you know. There was a video the other day, this young boy Mohammed, he's 10 years old, he got hit with a shell. His sister was next to him, she got her leg blown off, and when she woke up, she didn't even know her brother was dead, you know. And she's like, I want my bear, you know, like, how's Mohammed? And he's dead, you know. And it's like,
where was this?
In northeast Syria, in Rojava. It's like day three and they killed a kid.
This was reported in the mainstream?
Well, I don't know if it was on mainstream. No, it was actually, that's a lie. It was definitely reported in the mainstream, you know. And there's this horrible video of the dad holding his son just weeping, you know. And it's just like, This is crazy. But then you have all these DC analysts want to talk about, well, they should have seen this coming. Well, sorry that the people on the ground who are just trying to live didn't see this coming. You know, it's very easy to say that, but you forget, you know, especially if you cover the war from the front line and actually go there, as me and a lot of other journalists do. Like, when you meet these people, these aren't just subjects in your film. These are your friends often, you know, and it's very sad.
Yeah, man, I don't know what to say.
It's a real shame.
Everything just,
you know,
feels, yeah, everything just feels so chaotic as the years have gone on.
Yeah,
and the situation ever since, you know, I mentioned that I'm doing another episode after you with an academic here in the U.S., Joshua Landis. Mm-hmm. And in preparing for that, I wrote some stuff out. And it seems to me that ever since the end of the Cold War, we began to see fractures along sectarian lines in all of these artificially constructed countries, whether we're talking about the Balkans or whether we're talking about the Middle East. Countries that were artificially put together after World War I or after World War II. And then after the Iraq invasion, it feels like things have really gotten out of control. And the next accelerant was, of course, Syria. And it seems now that we've gone from having destabilization in Iraq and a re-sort of configuration along sectarian lines, Sunni, Shia, and Kurds, to now getting to a place where it's right across the border from Europe. I mean, Turkey is the gateway to Europe.
Exactly. And this is why Europe is so scared of them. They have explicitly threatened, like, we will release millions of refugees. Literally, they have millions of refugees in the, you know, in their holding pens, basically. And they've threatened Europe directly, like, we'll just release them all. They'll come to you. So Europe is terrified of this, you know. And unfortunately, there are people that Europe feels like they have to deal with. In fact, a lot of countries have come out, Finland, France, I read even Germany, but I'm not sure how true that one is. But they've stopped selling weapons to Turkey. I mean, they should have done this years ago. But, it, you know, there's definitely a very real sense that these are our allies from a lot of people, you know. But without America's support, it means nothing, unfortunately. You know, like, Europe is really weak in terms of the geopolitical outlook, I think.
So, Jake, let me ask you one more question.
Sure.
I mentioned, how does this play out? The way I'm visualizing this is these forces have been now unleashed, right? That Turkey broke through the border.
Yeah.
A new alliance is now forming, as I said, between the YPG, Russia, and Syria. Well, Syria and Russia have already been aligned. I don't even know where to begin to talk about what the Iranian view is on all of this. They don't seem to be a major player, but I'm certainly they're interested in what's happening.
Oh, they have Saudis, a lot of fighters. Iran have a lot of fighters. They send them to back Assad, you know. So like Hezbollah, for example. I mean, I know they're Lebanon, but they're Iranian, you know. So Hezbollah is on the side of Assad. Loads of fighters from Iran on Assad's side. So they're definitely there, you know.
Right. And the Israelis and the Saudis. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that the new center of gravity may be some type of detente, some type of stability that will form along the Turkish-Syrian border again. I don't know exactly where that will be or how that would be, but what's the next sort of natural place of friction that you see where this can, some stability can emerge now from this new dynamic?
Honestly, I don't even know. Like, it's one of them ones where I just can't work it out. It's almost like I cannot believe they've allowed this to happen. So no one thought it would happen like this, I don't think. Well, everyone did, but just the speed at which it's happening, I guess. And I don't know, like, if YPG end up with this little coalition with the Syrian army, then they will have to fold under them officially. Like, they'll have to stop being the SDF because that's an American construction, you know? So they'll have to basically formalize as a part of the Assad regime. And frankly, the Rojava revolution is dead when that happens, in my opinion. But the only way they can save their people from the back of that revolution, I guess, is to do this. You know, they don't want to be with Assad. They've been fighting Assad their whole lives, you know, longer than they've been fighting ISIS. But it is.
So are we talking about a reconstitution of the old Syrian state? Is that what this is?
Yeah, this is a land grab, basically. I think, like, so someone said it right today. Basically, the Assad forces, because YPG said, yes, okay, you can come into our areas now. Basically, Assad got more land back today than they have in the last 5 years. So, you know, in one day combined.
What about arguments that Erdogan has larger territorial ambitions and that this is part of that? It isn't simply a matter of combating terrorism at the border.
Well, it's true. Already, literally today, I only just saw it earlier. So basically, he's already officially said that. He said, yes, we are now going to go all the way to the south. So basically, when he said we're just going into the north, and everybody knew that he was not going to stop there, and everybody said he's not going to stop there, within 7 days, he said, yeah, we're going further now. Yeah.
So now, when he says the south, what does he mean? Like how far
well,
down?
Well, he wants to... He's
to the government-controlled areas or
yeah,
to the
yeah,
south?
Yeah, to the government.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like going down the M4 road all the way, it's just like... I don't know. I mean, you got to remember, these guys actually hate each other. You know, like Assad and Erdogan have actually been like enemies. But I do think there will be a deal with Assad and Turkey, not directly, but there'll be some understanding through Russia. I think, look, it's a lot easier for Assad to control the YPG areas after Turkey have battered them and, you know, killed so many people. I think it's, you know, my enemy of my enemy is my friend vibe with them too right now. So, you know what I mean? It's like a lot easier to then take back the area after Turkey has destroyed it quite a bit, because before it wouldn't have happened.
Jake, are you going to be covering this on your podcast? Are you going to have any guests coming up in the next week?
Yeah, man. Normally on Popular Front podcast, we just have one guest, but I think I'm going to do a big thing where I speak to, you know, people on the ground, analysts, people who have been there, people who are coming back. You know, I want to do a big kind of full circle of it all.
So people can find that on any major podcast platform?
Yeah, any major podcast platform, Spotify, iTunes, all of that. Just search Popular Front. If you go to the website, it's popularfront.co. And the way we're funded is we have, like I said, no corporate backing. We sell like bonus content on Patreon. So that's patreon.com/popularfront. You know, we do a lot of very different interviews on there, you know, so.
Like I said, it's a very interesting concept. I've never come across anything like it before. Again, you said the name was Popular Front. Jake, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, mate, thank you so much. I'm glad people care about this, definitely.
Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded at Creative Media Design Studio in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.